Hello, and welcome to Under New Management, the podcast that examines new and notable management research and how this research can enhance your effectiveness as a leader in your organization. I'm Morella Hernandez, an assistant professor of management and organization in the Foster School of Business at the University of Washington in Seattle. In this episode, I talk with Joshua Margolis of the Harvard Business School and Andy Malinsky of Brandeis University. We discuss a paper they have coming out in the Academy of Management Journal on how managers perform necessary evils. Joshua and Andy, welcome to Under New Management.
Glad to be here, Morella.
We're very happy to have you both on the podcast. We're excited to learn about your research on necessary evils. Can you tell us how you became interested in doing research on necessary evils?
As the case is with most of my research ideas and interests, it began through personal experience. During my first semester teaching following my PhD, I had an unfortunate incident of plagiarism in my classroom. And I had to discipline two students who had copied another student's assignment. I didn't have much experience at the time, and I was definitely a novice in the terms that we now use to classify necessary evil performers. I remember how intensely emotionally difficult it was for me to handle the situation and discipline the students, but also how important I felt it was to treat them in a compassionate and interpersonally sensitive manner, even when delivering a negative message. Now, since this time, I've unfortunately had to perform many other necessary evils as a professor, delivering bad news to students who have worked hard but whose work isn't up to par, or writing disappointing feedback to authors as a reviewer for a journal when the authors have clearly worked hard at revising a paper, but the paper still doesn't meet the standards of the journal. But that first time was very poignant to me, and it motivated me to connect with my graduate school friend and colleague, Joshua Margolis, who had similar experiences to me and who was also very interested in this phenomenon. And we got to talking about how these necessary evils were quite common across the professions and how it seemed that in previous scholarly research, few people had actually focused on the perspective of the performer called upon to deliver these negative but necessary tasks. So armed with this personal experience and what we felt was a good potential for making a scholarly contribution, we began our joint research program into necessary evils as an academic phenomenon.
And Joshua, how did you become interested in studying necessary evils?
First, thanks, Morella, for inviting Andy and me to discuss the research that's really compelled both of us since the time that we used to just have conversations on the phone or meet to discuss various ideas over lunch. And both Andy and I had an interest in how people perform a certain type of a task. And the tasks we were really compelled by were those that at once require people to be really resourceful and creative, but at the same time tend to bombard people with pressures that are likely to inhibit that resourcefulness or creativity. So, for example, taking on an ethical challenge or operating in a foreign culture. In both of those cases, managers have to really be at their best. They have to be fully engaged. But those are exactly the sorts of challenging tasks that typically drain people and narrow their range of response, the way that they'll typically take on and act in those conditions. So Andy and I were really interested in investigating how people who have no choice but to do these sorts of tasks, these really draining and demanding tasks, and that when they have to do them under really unforgiving conditions, how do they manage to get them done? That was really the question that I think propelled us to look for a class of tasks, and necessary evils seem to hit the mark.
And you talk about these demanding tasks, and Andy gave us some great examples of what professors perhaps would consider a necessary evil. Joshua, can you give us some examples of what managers would consider a necessary evil within the organization?
Necessary evils abound across different types of organizations. So, for example, in our study, we heard from managers about firing people, laying people off, terminating contracts. In fact, one manager told us about having to terminate a contract over the phone in the middle of dinner. And they also, managers also recounted lots of episodes of delivering negative performance reviews. Doctors recounted to us their experiences of doing painful medical procedures like a spinal tap or what they call lumbar punctures. And also they recounted their experiences delivering alarming diagnoses, that is bad news to patients who weren't expecting it. We also studied police officers who described their experiences evicting people from their homes or serving arrest warrants. And we studied addiction counselors in a tough love therapeutic facility, and the necessary evils they had to perform included disciplining clients and sometimes even expelling them.
Interesting. Question for Andy. Can you explain a little bit more about how these necessary evils affect the organization and its members?
Sure. Depending on how they're performed, necessary evils can have a great impact on the organization and its members. A long line of academic research by Joel Brockner, Bob Bees, Rob Folger, Jerry Greenberg, and others has shown how critical it is on a number of counts to perform necessary evils in an interpersonally sensitive manner. In other words, behavior that attends to the needs and rights and feelings of the victims. This research has shown that performing necessary evils in an interpersonally sensitive manner protects the dignity and welfare of the victim. It reduces negative reactions from the harmed party, and it increases the commitment and productivity of surviving members of the organization. For example, in a recent study, Alan Lind of Duke University and his colleagues from Ohio State found that employees who felt that they were not treated with interpersonal sensitivity during a downsizing were far more likely to file wrongful termination claims against their organization, which can run companies up to $100,000 per suit to defend, and that's a conservative guess. About the cost. Employees can also vent their anger about not being treated well in other ways. There have been many recent accounts in the media of people laid off or fired in what they perceive to be a less than dignifying manner, stealing from organizations, or even in some cases, re-entering organizations with firearms and taking employees hostage. There was actually a recent account in the New York Times of a longtime employee who was laid off from a New Jersey chemical company. He sabotaged the company's computer system, causing over $20 million in damage. He felt disrespected in terms of how he was let go, and he wrote a note, actually, to the president of the company where he said, "I've been loyal to the company in good and bad times over 30 years. I was expecting a member of top management to come down from his ivory tower to face us with a layoff announcement rather than sending the kitchen supervisor with guards to escort us off the premises like criminals. You will pay for your senseless behavior."
Wow.
So extensive research has examined the importance of interpersonal sensitivity for organizations and its members. And our distinctive contribution is to focus on the performers. Little work has examined the performer's perspective, but that perspective is obviously critical in order to understand how organizations can achieve all the benefits of interpersonally sensitive conduct that have been outlined and documented in previous research. So we're tilting the focus towards performers, and in our work we attempt to bring that performer's perspective to life. We find that performers describe their internal experience of performing a necessary evil in rich and poignant terms. They use metaphors like an emotional roller coaster, a barrel going over the falls, going into a college exam knowing that they're going to get an F. One manager described the experience by saying, "It's a very uncomfortable feeling. Anyone who tells you that they don't mind laying off people, in my humble opinion, I think is crazy." Another manager said, "It's never easy to terminate anyone. It's the worst thing that I've ever had to do as a manager." But as we detail in our most current work, the work profiled here, an overwhelming percentage of managers and other professionals, even under these emotionally intense conditions, were highly motivated to engage with the experience of performing a necessary evil. One manager explained in his own words, "The day it doesn't bother you is the day I don't want you doing it anymore, because you need to have it bother you in order to do it well."
Engagement seems like a pretty critical aspect of this process, and I want to delve a little deeper into the performer's perspective by asking Joshua about the two terms that are discussed in your paper, psychological disengagement and psychological engagement.
Well, we found that professionals respond in one of two ways to their own experience of necessary evils. One, psychological disengagement, has been well documented in prior research, but the other, psychological engagement, is something that emerged in our data, we think in many ways for the first time in such rich detail. These two psychological responses differ along three dimensions. So let me explain disengagement first and then engagement second. So in keeping with prior research, we found that sometimes people who perform necessary evils disengage psychologically. So this means, one, that they distance themselves from their own emotions. Two, it meant that they detached themselves from the harmed person's experience. Remember that they're right in front of someone who is going through emotional, physical, or material harm or pain. And so one aspect of disengagement is that people would sometimes detach themselves from the experience of the other person. And third, we found that sometimes disengagement entailed really dehumanizing yourself. That is, those performing necessary evils would sometimes separate themselves or their human side entirely from the role that they were performing. So disengagement meant distancing from your own emotion, detaching yourself from the experience of the person on the receiving end of the harm, or dehumanizing yourself or subjugating your own identity and sense of humanity to the role you were playing. In sharp contrast, and really contrary to what's been found in prior research, a majority of the people that we studied described the ways in which they, in fact, psychologically engaged with their experience of performing necessary evils. So this, too, consisted of these three dimensions, but it was the opposite side of the coin. That is, we found that sometimes people would connect with their own emotional experience of doing the task. That is, they would feel quite deeply a sense of guilt or sympathy or sadness at having to impose the sort of harm that they were being called upon to impose. Second, we found that they often remained acutely attuned to the experience of the harmed person. That is, rather than trying to ignore it or dissociate themselves from the toll that the task was taking on someone else, they in fact tried to connect to it. They in fact tried to remain actively cognizant of the harmful effect that they were having. And the third dimension was, we found that people who engaged really humanized themselves. It was important to them to sustain their own humanity, to feel that they weren't just responding as some sort of insensate professional or in some automated fashion. What they were trying to do was keep their own human sensitivity alive.
Well, I'm interested to hear what the primary findings were. Andy, can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. As we explained, past research in harm doing has traditionally emphasized how people disengage from their own experience of doing the task and from the victims of their actions, getting the task done as quickly as possible and not in a particularly interpersonally sensitive manner. So contrary to what others have found, we found extensive evidence of engagement. People engaged psychologically with the experience of performing a necessary evil. They connected with their own emotional experience as opposed to disconnecting from this experience. They remained attuned to the target's experience as opposed to dissociating from the target's experience, and they humanized themselves. In fact, people engaged in more than half of all episodes, and this pattern was relatively consistent across occupations and experience level and gender. So psychological engagement was our first primary finding. And the second primary finding was that people also engaged interpersonally with the victims of their actions, extending highly personalized and sensitive treatment towards victims. So, for example, managers deviated from their scripts and accompanied fired employees out of the building. And in one manager's own words, he said, "If there was a way I could help him preserve his respect and dignity in a very difficult setting, then that is what I wanted to do." And I walked with him all the way out, down the lobby, to the door of the building, and shook his hand. A doctor described creatively and spontaneously coaxing a father to sing to his young son in order to be able to help soothe the child during a very painful procedure. Police officers offered food, water, time, support in response to perceived need. Now, although some performers certainly exhibited disengaged behavior, as predicted from prior research, in more than half of the episodes in our data, there was at least one instance of personalized treatment, again, with similar levels across occupation, experience, and gender. A particularly poignant example that Joshua and I often draw upon to illustrate this idea of personalizing, a police officer described, in fact, a police officer I met during my ride-along described how he treated a young couple, two struggling musicians, as he evicted them from their home. And in his own words, he said, "I'm glad I took the time to talk to them. It was after. The eviction was complete. They were outside. I spent 10 minutes talking to them, giving them what I thought was good advice, not that they would take it or anything. They needed a hug. That's what I was doing, talking to them, a verbal hug." So our third primary finding combines these insights about how a performer responds inside, intrapersonally, and how they treat the victim interpersonally. And we inductively derived a typology of response styles, capturing how people respond to their own experience and simultaneously how they treat the target of their actions. And there were four different styles that we identified in our data. The first was an integrated style, blending both that internal engagement with one's own experience and also personalized treatment towards the victim. But there was also a guarded style that combined engaging internally, but externally producing behavior that lacked in personalization. A third style was what we called a style of detached concern, where performers personalize the way that they treat someone, but inside remain psychologically disengaged. And then finally, the fourth style is what we call a mechanical style, where the performers neither engage psychologically inside, nor do they produce that type of personalized compassion that we've highlighted.
Now, I want to find out more about the practical applications of your research for organizations. Joshua, can you talk a little bit to managers about those practical applications?
Sure, Marilla. Let me touch on two levels of practical applications that Andy and I feel are especially relevant for managers. First, at the organizational level, we feel that organizations cannot simply expect people to deliver sensitive interpersonal treatment. As one manager in our study recounted, and these are the manager's words, quote, "It's very difficult from an emotional standpoint, knowing you are dealing with somebody's livelihood, dealing with somebody's ego, dealing with somebody's ability to provide for their family. It's just simply a really difficult task to perform." So organizations need to support those who are asked to perform necessary evils. And that requires two different forms of support. So even as companies provide the standard set of policies and practices for ensuring a basic level of sensitive interpersonal treatment, they also have to find ways to enable personalized responses. So carefully choreographed sequences for layoffs, for example, along with the verbatim scripts that companies sometimes supply or the handy phrases that they teach people, are certainly vital in preparing those managers who have to deliver the necessary evil so that they'll be able to accord at least a minimum of interpersonally sensitive conduct. But at the same time, those practices, those off-the-shelf types of practices, can choke the people, the managers, who are in fact able to engage psychologically and deliver the sort of customized creative treatment that accords the person on the receiving end of the harm a personal touch. So organizations need to facilitate flexibility in those who are going to deliver necessary evils. And what that means is that we think that companies could design training that educates and exposes managers to the unsettling experience they're likely to go through when they perform necessary evils, so they're better equipped when they have to perform those tasks. And when they're better equipped and when they can anticipate what's going to happen, they're more likely to be able to respond in an engaged and personalized fashion. But at the same time, if they have the set of scripts or off-the-shelf kinds of phrases or resources, that can help them in the most unsettling instances, and it can assure a baseline level of appropriate treatment of those who are being harmed by the necessary evil. But this sets up the second level of practical applications that we see emerging from our research, and those are practical applications at the individual level, particularly relevant for individual managers, regardless of what their organizations do or do not do to support them. So first, what we find in our research is that there are a lot of ways to treat people sensitively, a lot of ways to treat those on the receiving end of the harm in a just and compassionate manner, from the tone of voice you use to your mere presence, even spending just a few extra minutes, or sometimes what we found was not doing things, that is, exercising restraint. For example, many doctors say that they'll only do X number of rounds of a procedure, and if it doesn't go right, they'll pause. Or the police officers in our study would often say that the main way they could deliver interpersonal sensitivity and just and compassionate treatment was in what they did not do, making sure that they restrained themselves, even when they had cause to potentially be more forceful than they were being. And certainly for the managers, a lot of discretion and restraint meant how they handled necessary evils. For example, just delivering a layoff or a negative performance review out of the flow of normal traffic of the organization. All of these are about discretion and restraint, which is an alternative way of thinking about how to deliver a necessary evil.
That makes a lot of sense. So what would you say then is the bottom line for managers?
Well, the bottom line for managers, don't underestimate how hard these are for you or your people. If you want to do them with compassion and dignity and with an engaged approach, you really have to take seriously the manager's own perspective, the emotions that the manager will experience, and the challenges of incorporating these emotions into an appropriate response.
And Joshua, what would you say is the bottom line for managers?
The bottom line for managers is both a caution and encouragement. First, the caution. Beware of looking for the comfortable route, the one that will limit your personal involvement and protect you from emotion. Like it or not, necessary evils require managers to live with a degree of ambivalence. But that is also encouraging because we found that those who are able to grasp their own very real and raw human emotions, as well as the negative impact that they were having on others, were often able to meet three crucial criteria of effectiveness. First, they got the task done. Second, they treated the other person with decency and dignity. And third, they were able to sustain their own sense of integrity by simultaneously meeting their professional responsibility and by expressing their heartfelt human sympathy.
Well, thank you so much, Joshua and Andy, for joining us in Under New Management. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you about your research on necessary evils.
Thank you, Morella, for the opportunity.
Yes, thank you very much, Morella. We enjoyed it.
Thank you for downloading Under New Management, a podcast of the Organizational Behavior Division of the Academy of Management. The OB Division has over 5,000 members dedicated to the science and practice of organizational behavior. For more information about the OB Division, visit www.obweb.org. For more information about the Academy of Management and its over 17,000 members worldwide, visit www.aomonline.org. Computer support for this podcast is provided by Vu Tran.